Doctor Show.
You have all made it through the dance. You have all made it.
Coming to you from the X-Access, it's John of All Trades with your host, John X.
Welcome to the John of All Trades podcast, episode 69. I'm your host, John X. Thank you for joining us. Glad to have you back once again. We are in the dog days of summer. Here we are, August. Weather's hot. Time to be outside. Time for sports. And that's exactly what we have this week. Great guest this week. Someone I am very excited to talk to. Guy named Tim Lawler. And Tim Lawler is currently the head golf pro at Lakewood Country Club. My dad is a member of Lakewood Country Club. He's been a member for, I would say, at least 20 years. It's a great place, great club, great atmosphere, wonderful course, tough course. We talk about that in this week's episode with Tim, about how Lakewood has not the longest yardage, but is a surprisingly challenging course. And it's one that gives people a lot of satisfaction to play it, just because you don't necessarily expect it to be that hard when you look at the total yardage. But, you know, it's got some terrain changes, got a lot of woods, and just a fun place to play. So Tim, for the last 20 years, has been the head pro at Lakewood Country Club. But before that, he was a Major League Baseball pitcher, had a really good career, was drafted by the Yankees in 78, played for them for a while, got traded to the San Diego Padres, pitched in the World Series in 84. And 84 is a particularly meaningful year in our family because it was the first time in 39 years that the Cubs made it to the postseason. And they ran into this Padres team, took the first two games, and then lost the last three. The Padres went on to the World Series. And that was a year my dad, he really took it hard. My dad's a diehard Cub fan, grew up in Chicago. I mean, that probably should have been the Cubs' year, but they ran into this Padres team. The Padres took 3 out of 5, and that's all there was to it. So Tim actually played in the World Series, ran into just a juggernaut of a Detroit team, was opening day starter once, played for not only the Padres, but the White Sox and the Red Sox. And so he has great insight into the life of a major leaguer. We talk baseball, we talk about pitching, we talk about how pitching is different now than it was then. So if you love baseball, if you're sort of a baseball nerd like I am, I think you'll enjoy this chat quite a bit, because how often do you really get to talk to a Major League Baseball player? For me, I mean, this was probably one of my first times ever. And for me, the only time I got to do that in a very like intimate one-on-one setting. So to get to pick the brain of someone who has been there, who's been in the show, was huge. It was awesome. It was so much fun to talk to Tim. So we get into things like pitching inside and baseball's unwritten rules. And it's funny, as I talk to him, I have sort of my own opinion about the unwritten rules of the game and sort of how that plays out. But I was never there. You know, I've never been a Major League Baseball player. And I was grateful to get to talk to Tim and hear his insight from the player's perspective. And I got a lot out of that. So it was just so cool to get to listen to him. Additionally, we talk about how he got into his second act. That's something I've always been curious about with pro athletes. I mean, your career is over, in Tim's case, in his early 30s. I'm in my early 30s now. And as I say in the episode, I feel like I'm just getting started. I mean, your 20s are sort of trying to establish yourself and build yourself up and get to a place where you have professional credibility and some respect and are able to do some different things. In baseball, his career was done. So his second act started right about the time I'm at now in my life. So it was fascinating to get to understand that and talk about that. We spent some time talking about golf, and I asked him some questions about golf culture, about baseball culture. Like I said, it's a great episode with someone who has been there, someone who is experiencing it, someone who lived it every day. And it's the type of episode that I'm just so thrilled to bring you here on the podcast. A couple of very quick plugs. Like us on Facebook, J-O-A-T Pod. Follow us on Twitter, J-O-A-T Pod. And if you have an idea for an episode, someone you think I should talk to, or maybe you yourself have an interesting job, hit me up. Those are great places to do it. You can always find me at the website. There will be contact info there. The website for John of All Trades is johnofalltrades.us. That's J-O-N of all trades.us. And you can listen to this episode on iTunes and on Stitcher. So just search John of All Trades. You'll find us at both of those locations. So this week's episode, let's get it started. It's episode 69. We talked to Tim Lawler, head golf pro at Lakewood Country Club, as well as former Major League Baseball pitcher. So sit back, enjoy this episode, enjoy summer, everyone. It's going to be over before you know it. So get out there, enjoy it, enjoy baseball, enjoy golf, and enjoy this episode. Episode 69, Tim Lawlor, starts right now.
The golf business is determined by weather, and unfortunately, early season, we were inundated with rain and consequently lost a lot of number of rounds. And you know, that definitely has an impact on the business side of it.
Sure.
Hopefully, in the days that we were open during that time period, you know, there was huge member demand.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet.
So that created a whole different series of issues because sometimes you're not geared up staff-wise yet till what we call the beginning of the season, which is about May 1.
Huh. And when does the season usually start?
Well, you know, we're open year-round.
Right.
Every day, you know, we're closed on Mondays, but we do corporate outings and charity functions. We're very strong following with groups for that. But Tuesday through Sunday, the days we close pretty much Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's Day.
That's it.
The rest of the time, the golf shop's available. You know, members are traveling. Sometimes they need to make purchases. And that it's a service that, you know, they want and expect. And we try to provide it. So
yeah, no, absolutely. Given the weather earlier this season, did the course take a beating?
We were fortunate this year in a couple of the past seasons, and as you may or may not recall with some of the flooding, the unfortunate scenarios came around Colorado. But this particular year, we didn't have flooding. We did not have continuous cart paths on our golf course.
That's right.
So what was happening was there were many days that we were unable to get carts out, and you know, that's a big driving force for golf play.
Sure.
So we were idle a lot.
Yeah.
Too much so.
Yeah, it's got to be frustrating. So it's a lovely day today, sitting here.
We've got a full tee sheet, and you know, it's nice to have you know, the members out enjoying the golf course.
Sure.
Hopefully receiving the value that they feel that they get out of being a member here at Lakewood.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Lakewood's a great golf club, a lot of heritage, a lot of tradition here. This year we are 107 years old.
Wow.
Founded in 1908. I think my math's correct there.
Right.
And this clubhouse that we're in is, this is our eighth year for that. So even though we're 107 years old, we're virtually brand new. A new pool house, new pool, new clubhouse. It's quite a facility.
Well, it's gorgeous. I remember I read somewhere where you said, Lakewood is a deceptively difficult course. Where you said if someone comes to you playing it for the first time and they look at the yardage sheet, right, and what is it, about 6,500 yards?
6,700 from the back tees.
6,700.
A little over that, but...
Okay. And they say, it's not a lot of yardage. But I remember you saying something like, show me your scorecard.
Right.
Put everything out, show me your scorecard. And how often do people beat their handicap?
It's such a small percentage. I think actually what I said was I'd lay $20 on the line to players that would come in and legitimately put everything out. It's an extremely demanding golf course, but it's unique. Obviously, I'm biased.
Yeah, of course.
This
maybe
is
a bit of a homer.
Well,
here.
This is my 20th year.
Wow,
yes,
fantastic.
And so I'm definitely biased about the facility, the membership, and the golf course. But it's day in and day out. I think when you're looking for a private club, if you're in that category to be a private club member, you look for things like a golf course that's fun to play, it's fair, challenging, and you don't get tired of it. And that's the unique thing about Lakewood is it's just it's an original Tom Bendelow design.
Wow.
And then Donald Ross came in, I think it was about 1916, and kind of put his signature stamp on it. Had a couple of small renovations through there and during time since then, but for the most part, it's we try to uphold that Donald Ross tradition, and
it's a
great test. Very small greens, subtle undulations, and narrow fairways, tree line.
A lot of wood here. A lot of trees, I would say.
That's one of the things that you always want to try and play for a barkey whenever you know.
Right. Well, my dad's been a member here for as long as I can remember. So, I mean, I grew up around here, and it's a lovely place to be. And it's situated in a place where you might not necessarily expect it, which is cool.
It is, and when you walk through the hallways here, you see a lot of the old photographs of the property early on in formative years. At the time, you used to have to take a train from Denver to come out to the golf course, or horse and horse and carriage, or I guess they probably had some of the early automobiles at that time, but. It was definitely on the outskirts, and now we're completely landlocked and surrounded.
Oh, yeah.
And it is. I think the nickname is now the Emerald of Jefferson County.
Nice.
I think because it's so green and plush here.
Yeah. I'd never heard that before, but that's fitting.
Kind of right in the middle of an area that you wouldn't expect it.
Yeah. No. And I think that's one of the cool things about it. Mm-hmm. So it's good to be sitting here on a Thursday. Thanks for taking some time out of the day. Sitting here with Tim Lawler, Club Pro of Lakewood Country Club. So it's a pleasure to get to chat with you. I know you spent some time here. You know, you'll exchange a few words. But to get the chance to sit down, I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So you said you've been here for 20 years.
Yes.
And before that, did you come straight out of Major League Baseball into golf, or was there an intermediate stop in there?
There was a relatively short time, a year and a half, 2 years, maybe 2.5 years even, that I originally lived in Breckenridge when I first moved to Colorado, and built some homes up there, I really enjoyed that type of work. It was great seeing something happen every day.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
of accomplishment, the sort of
absolutely
daily incremental gains has got to be really cool to watch.
You know, it was very rewarding work. It wasn't my real calling. I didn't feel, and I didn't see myself doing it for an extended period of time and for the long future. During that time period, I started playing, I was always a golfer, but I played a lot there in the Breckenridge area, and the golf pro in Breckenridge, he and I are very good friends, and he and I would play together, and I ended up spending more and more time out at the golf course, and as I was in their pro shop, it was enjoyable.
Yeah.
And I think to be successful in the golf business, you really need to be a people person.
Sure, yeah.
And the ability to communicate again, we want people to have fun. So the longer that I kept hanging out there, I kept thinking that, wow, this would be nice to do. And so I ended up enrolling in the San Diego Golf Academy.
Yeah.
And it's a 4-semester program. And after the third semester, when the third semester ended, Errol, the pro at Breckenridge, called me up and said, hey, one of my lead guys is leaving. Would you like to come back and work?
Right.
Well, it was a great opportunity, so I just said yes. Yeah. So I didn't even finish the academy, and the rest is kind of history in my golf career, at
just
least.
Just kind of got the on-the-job training. Right.
Right. And ended up worked 4 different years up there, and then I took a job down here at Lakewood, and I've been here ever since.
So. What brought you to Colorado?
A very close, dear friend of mine and a fellow ball player, and most people probably wouldn't recognize his name, is Goose Gossage.
Not recognize his name, right.
You know, especially in Colorado.
Yeah, no,
obviously, Hall of Fame pitcher and great guy.
You're good friends with Goose?
I'm sorry?
You're good friends with Goose?
Oh, we played together on 2 different teams.
Oh, cool, yeah.
When I first came to the big leagues, with the Yankees, he and I were on the same team.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we formulated our friendship. And we're actually, I feel we're more like brothers that we've somehow got lost someplace.
Right.
But we've hunted together for a long number of years. And Then we also played together in San Diego.
Yeah.
During the times that I was hunting, when I came to Colorado and didn't live here, I still lived in San Diego.
Yeah.
Ended up, after I got traded from San Diego, I went from New York to San Diego, and then when I got traded from San Diego to Chicago, didn't really want to continue living in San Diego.
Right.
So, and I grew up in Missouri. I didn't want to go back there, so it just seemed like Colorado was about halfway in between, and I always had a good time here, so
just split the difference.
Ended up buying a lot and built a house, and the rest is, I've been a native since 1986.
Adopted native?
Yes.
Love it.
Yes. I saw a bumper sticker the other day. It was, I'll have to remember it maybe during this interview, but it was, I want to be a native or something like that.
Right, so. Right. I'm kind of doing this out of order, but since we were talking about golf, I've always been curious about folks who are pro athletes,
mm-hmm.
because you had, your career was from 80 to 87 approximately?
78 to 88 was kind of the years that I played.
Okay. I mean, that's 10 years, and you were what, 30 years old at that point, approximately?
No, let's see, without dating myself too sure. much. No, I was 30, I was 32 when I finished, 30, 32.
Okay, the weird thing to me is, I'm 33 as we sit here, uh-huh. and I'm sort of starting to get into the prime of my career in terms of what I do. But when you're an athlete, that happens so much earlier, and there's so much more life to live. I'm always curious about how you approach the second act. Because at some point, everyone's going to get told that, you're not going to play in the major leagues anymore. How do you sort of approach that and how did you sort of manage that?
Well, it's definitely a transition. I think that for me, I was probably a little different than some because my approach to life is I'm going to have fun.
Yeah.
And I want and need to enjoy myself in whatever I'm doing. And if I'm not enjoying myself or if I'm not having fun, I've always said I need to change. I need to do something different. And that's kind of what the case was with baseball. Ultimately, your performance dictates what happens.
Of course.
I mean, especially at that level and in that arena. But
there's guys coming up all the time who are all clawing
for
the same limited number of jobs.
There's 24, 25 now players on a major league roster, of which 10, 9, 10, 11, depending on the time of the season,
sure.
that are pitchers,
mm-hmm.
of which usually 4 or 5 are starting pitchers. And that was, for the most of my career, I was one of those, 4 or 5 players. And times 30 teams, so that's 150 people in the country and the world get right. to do that job.
Yeah.
So it's a very select crew,
yeah.
and a very unique opportunity to be a starting pitcher in the big leagues.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right. There are people behind you all the time, and that's it drives you to want to be successful. But on the other hand, it's something that I never really worried about because it was you have to go out and. You give your best effort, and whatever yeah. happens. So, it was a lot of fun.
So when it came time for the second act, were you not enjoying baseball as much as you had?
During the course of my career, baseball changed, and it's dramatically worse in my opinion now than from several aspects, but from the players' side of things, I should say, or pitchers' side of things.
Right.
As I said, performance dictates things, but if your heart isn't in what you're doing, you're not going to be successful.
Yeah.
And I think that's what ultimately happened to me, is I didn't enjoy the game as much. It had become a business.
Sure.
And that's what that transition went from sport to business and free agency and
yeah.
a lot of there's such an emphasis on the financial side of the game that a lot of the playing and the fun got taken out of it, especially to me. And so consequently, it was easy to walk away.
Yeah.
In retrospect, I don't regret anything there. But, you know, people will ask me if I miss baseball. I say, yeah, on the 1st and the 15th, you know, for paydays. But
sure.
But really, I probably the biggest thing I miss is the camaraderie.
Yeah.
That I, but there's been a replacement of that with the membership that I have here at this club. I mean, some of my best friends are members here, and we travel together, and we play golf together, and this is still that sports arena of golf, and there's still a locker room here, and there's still the same locker room banter that that we were able to experience playing baseball that occurs even now.
Sure, that's true. And golf, like baseball, I mean, baseball is a team sport, but it's so centered on individual effort.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's you versus the hitter. It's, you know, it's the hitter versus the pitcher. It's, you know, balls are hit to individual players, so on and so forth. I mean, you have to work as a cohesive team, but it's such an individual game, as is golf.
Right.
So you mentioned that that you think baseball, especially now, has gotten worse from the player's side. Can you expand on that? In what ways would you say, from the beginning of your career, did it change to the end of your career?
Well, social media has changed obviously a lot of things in everyone's life. But from the professional athlete's perspective, it's very difficult to have any privacy now.
Yeah.
And that's one thing. If, you know, to have a family and players, literally, you're under a microscope all the time. And yes, you try to live your life in a manner that is people can look up to you. You know,
sure.
you do realize that, you know, sometimes kids are idolizing, players. And yes, you always want to have your best foot forward. But on that other side of it, you can't walk out of your hotel without, you know, cameras going all the time, phones, and,
Well, everyone's a journalist now.
Right.
Literally, everyone's a journalist.
And so that's one side of it, that impact. The second, from a pitcher's perspective, is the way that the game has changed. The hitters are protected so much now. It's a crock, literally. I mean, to be successful as a pitcher, you have to be able to pitch inside.
Yeah.
And, you know, hitters now, I mean, if you pitch on the inside third and everybody's whining and jumping out of the way, and the umpires,
chest out.
And then the umpires, you know, the umpires try to take control of the game now too. I would have a very difficult time pitching now because I don't know how long I could stay in the game, because I always felt like, you know, the plate, 17 inches wide, 18, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I always divided the plate into thirds. And since I pitched inside, that inner third was always the hitter's third. Hmm. You know, anything I threw in there, you know, that's hit it.
That's okay? Meat, right?
Right. That's that. The middle third, if you throw one in there, it's a mistake.
Oh, right. Okay, I follow you.
And if the hitter gets that third too, okay?
Yeah.
The outer third of the plate, though, that's mine.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the biggest issue that I see with pitchers today, is that they don't take command of their third of the plate. Because how can you try to make a living pitching when the hitter gets the whole plate?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a tough, you know, if they can feel comfortable up there,
right,
and be able to just to, okay, sit, it's a lot of times you're just sitting in a rocking chair at home plate thinking, okay, I'm just going to wail on this.
Right.
Well, I got a problem with that, because I'm trying to make a living too on the mound, and if I can't have part of that plate, Houston, we got a problem.
Right.
So
when you say you're sort of your inability to pitch inside because everyone's so jumpy, and there's been a lot of talk about the unwritten rules of the game and, you know, throwing at guys, but you're talking about pitching inside, not necessarily putting one in a guy's ear, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you can pitch inside and throw strikes, and, you know, there's purpose pitches.
Right.
You've got to keep hitters honest.
Sure.
If you're when you're on the mound, and again, there's this salaries, ownership. You know, the owners don't want their star players on the DL.
No, of course not.
You know, so there's this kind of, when you talk about unwritten rules, it's kind of, well, we've got to protect the hitters, so that means the pitchers can't pitch inside or can't hit the guys. And you know what? The way the game is, if you deserve it, you're going to get it.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's old school baseball.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I think about a guy like Barry Bonds who used to stand right over the top of the plate mm-hmm. with the armor on. Mm-hmm. And you go, he's up there with no consequence, basically.
Wow.
It was a free base for him.
The guy that I would compare that to is Donnie Baylor.
Okay.
You know? Donnie stood, and I think he ended up leading the major leagues in number of times hit by pitch.
I think he got surpassed by Biggio.
Oh, okay.
But for the longest time, it was his record.
And, you know, and that was his hitting style, and he accepted the consequences.
Yeah, he owned it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, he wanted to cover as much of the plate as possible, so that's where he stood. And if he got hit, he didn't care because he you know, that was the risk reward.
Yeah.
And
it was part of the calculus.
You know, so he did. He got hit a lot.
Right.
And you know, if a guy did that now, I could say that everybody would be squawking at the pitchers,
right.
You know, say, well, you got to throw the ball over the plate. That's the name of the game.
Yeah.
And if the hitter has no fear up there,
right,
that's you're not going to be very successful as a pitcher.
Are there ways to work around that? I mean, obviously there are successful pitchers now in this, you know, in this era. What would be a potential workaround for that?
Well, I think being effectively wild helps.
Okay.
You know,
right?
You have just enough wildness that
right.
they can't really tell, well, is he throwing at somebody or is he just, you know, doesn't know where it's going some of the time. And that's a...
How important is your relationship with your catcher then, if you're going to be effectively wild? Because you got to have confidence that he's, if you're throwing it in the dirt, he's got to be on his
well,
toes.
And when I say effectively wild, that means you're coming inside.
Oh, okay, I gotcha.
Okay, that you've... You know, and you don't have to throw it. When people get hit above the shoulders, those are mistake pitches.
Right.
You know, I mean, it is the pitcher usually opens up, especially a right-handed pitcher, opens up too quickly, and you know,
yeah, flies
arms lagging, and the ball's tailing more, and it takes off and flies.
Right.
Usually the intentional ones are from the ribs.
Yeah.
To the knees.
Yeah, right in the butt.
Usually. You know, and those are the message
ones.
But it's okay to throw, you know, the ball 2 inches off of a player's waist to move them off of the plate. And I think that to me is effective pitching. It's not a strike.
Right.
But it's, you keep the person honest.
Right.
They can't just sit and be leaning over the plate all the time.
Right, I got you. Because I know in high school and college, you were a good hitter too, right? You played
mm-hmm.
some DH,
yes.
played some first. Did your sort of understanding of how you thought as a hitter, did that influence the way that you pitched then? Or did one influence the other in any way?
I mean, that's a good question. I really, I had a pretty simple hitting philosophy. It was see the ball and hit it.
Okay.
And
that sounds easier said than done, though.
You know, for whatever reason, a lot of times it was easier hitting a baseball than it is hitting a golf ball.
Huh.
You know, and the golf ball's just sitting there. But I have, you know, I was fortunate. I was blessed with good hand-eye coordination. And, I mean, you have milliseconds to identify what type of pitch, the speed, the spin, the direction, the location, and throw your hands at the ball.
Yeah.
And hit it, you know, hit it where it's pitched. And that was kind of the... In a simplistic description, that's how I hit.
Right.
But
well, it seemed to work for you.
I was probably a better hitter than I was a pitcher.
Really?
When I signed, I mean, I had been an All-American designated hitter out of Arkansas.
Yeah.
And I signed as a pitcher first baseman. And my first year and a half in the first half season plus the next year, I did both in the minor league. When I went to Double A to start out up in West Haven, Connecticut.
West Haven. What team is that? What's
that was the West Haven Yankees.
West Haven Yankees, okay.
And,
just called the Yankees.
So I DH'd. I played first. I played the outfield, and I pitched. In my second year in the minors, my first full year, because I didn't report till after the draft in June of that
right,
year.
Right, of course.
But my next full year, about midway through the season, I could see that by taking all of the time that was necessary to both hit and pitch, all of my skills were suffering.
Sure, yeah.
And I met with the minor league director about that time. I said, I think, pitching is always the quickest way to the big leagues, especially being a left-handed pitcher.
Yeah.
And so I just told him, I said, I'd just like to focus on pitching. And he was fine with that. And I ended up the next year, I reported to AAA, and then I got called up to big leagues. So,
were you disappointed to be in the American League, given your skills for hitting?
I think it was a lot of my skills were wasted. It was a funny story. When I got traded over to the White Sox for the 85 season.
From San Diego?
Right. And Tony La Russa was the manager, and I took batting practice every day in the American League with the extra players. And nobody really said much with Chicago, but I got traded from Chicago to Boston right about the All-Star break that year. So John McNamara was manager at that time, so I report to the Red Sox, and I had a reputation of being a good hitter.
Yeah.
And so Mac said the same thing. He says, I want you to take batting practice. A couple of the extra players, because there's minimal time for the extra players to get their swings during BP. And a couple of the guys were like grumbling about it. And, well, how come you're in here? And I said, well, probably because I think I'm a better hitter than you are. And I ended up, I did pinch hit a few times in the American League. And so it was some kind of funny times.
That's cool. My entry point into sort of understanding... This is a lead-in to a next question, so bear with me. Do you see the movie Moneyball?
I've seen parts of it.
Okay. The part I want to ask you about is when Brad Pitt makes Jonah Hill tell, I think it's Carlos Pena, that he's been traded. He said, don't sugarcoat it. Just say, Carlos, you've been traded to the Tigers. Here's this man's info. He'll handle all the arrangements for you. We wish you the best.
Mm-hmm.
He said, that's it. They're professional ball players. They can handle it. What is it like from the player's perspective to get traded? What is the process like, and how do you feel?
Well, the good thing about being traded is that somebody else wants you.
Right. That's a good point.
Okay. So that's a nice feeling. My skill sets are still such that somebody thinks I'm valuable.
Right. They're getting broken up.
They're willing to give something up to get you.
Sure.
Okay. So that's that's kind of a nice, a warm and fuzzy.
You're getting broken up with, but you're going to it's like relationships. Well, this relationship's over.
Right.
Ooh, but I got a new one. Someone who wants.
Right. That's a segue into another story, maybe here in a minute.
Okay,
time,
but good.
The obviously coming from when I left San Diego in '84, we had just we had a phenomenal team, had a great chemistry with that team, and we lost the World Series, unfortunately, to Detroit.
Yep. But that Detroit team was a monster that year.
Yeah, that was it was a great experience, not only personally but professionally as well. And so going from that team to the White Sox, well, the White Sox had a good team too, but it was, you look at it as, well, like I said, at least somebody wants you, but also the fact that, you're going to meet new players, new teammates. And Tom Seaver and I were pretty good buddies. And so he was on that team when I got traded over. So, generally, either through playing against or something because of trades and everything else. You have some, not too many times you go from one team to another and you don't know someone, mm-hmm. at least. So it's not completely alien.
Right. Speaking of that 84 Padres team, has my dad forgiven you for being on that team?
Well, he must be a Cub fan.
He's a Cub fan. I think he still holds some animosity towards Steve Garvey to this day.
That was the game I pitched, too. So it was...
Does he know that?
I don't know. I started game four. And I wasn't around for the ending of it, but I was glad that it ended the way that it did.
I'll bet.
And, it was a unique scenario because the Cubs that year, in that series, we played the first two games in Chicago and... God, they just destroyed us.
Yeah.
And it was, they came back.
It was game one, like 13 to nothing or something?
Right. That one was like double digit win, I think.
Right.
So we go back out to San Diego, And it was almost a feeling as if the Cubs, what our team felt like was that the Cubs just felt like all they had to do was show up.
Right.
Okay. So then we won game three, and then we won game four, and then ultimately we won game five. And, you know, it was some self-destruction on their part a little bit too, but, you know, that's part of the game. It was very gratifying to come back in that particular series. And then, unfortunately, we ran into Detroit. And it was kind of, you know, I hate to use the word destiny, but it was, I mean, Willie Hernandez was like, king of the world that year.
Right.
So, anyways.
Well, you mentioned also that at 30 teams back then, what, like 26 teams, I think?
I believe, yes, before expansion. Uh-huh.
I think so. And so 26 teams, 150 or so pitchers, and 120, what would that be, 130 pitchers then? And only 26 of those get to be opening day starters.
Right.
But you did that in 83, right?
Yes.
That's a hell of an honor. That's a feather in your cap.
You know, it is absolutely. You know, after the 82 season was, I mean, I had numbers wise, that was my best year. I was 16-9, but I felt like 83. I had some arm injuries that I, you know, kind of tried to scuffle through.
Sure.
And 84, I ended up. I felt like I had a better year of pitching in 84 than I did in 82.
Yeah.
But the numbers, I still, as I say, Goose was our closer.
Right.
And I've never really gone back and looked, but I told him he cost me several years of my career because of games where, you know, I didn't have a lot of complete games, but I went, if you know, the older we get, the better we were.
Yeah.
As memory serves me, I got into the seventh and eighth innings a lot as a starter.
You went deep, yeah.
And, you know, it was kind of always those scenarios where I'd leave with a guy on base and you know, that guy's going to score and tie the game. We won a lot of games that I started.
Right.
But it was.
But it didn't show up in your.
Right. As if, you know, not the pitcher of record.
Yeah, yeah.
And so. Yeah, I still give him a ration of grief about costing me a bunch of years of my career. But.
Do you think it would have been helpful, given the focus on advanced analytics now, sabermetrics? Because a lot of the baseball writing I read now doesn't focus on wins and losses. It's more about the advanced metrics, and it sounds like what you're describing is that might have serviced you a little bit.
Oh, I'm sure, because it would be interesting to. I'm sure someplace has the
sure.
Those actual records to be able to compare. But
I'm sure someone's done it. Yeah.
But it was an interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. A few random questions for you.
Uh-huh.
Who was your least favorite hitter to face?
Buddy Bell.
Buddy Bell.
Uh huh.
Really?
When I was in the
former
American.
Manager of the Rockies
uh-huh.
too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I probably faced him 8 or 10 times. And I don't think he ever got less than a double off of me. And I.
Are you his favorite pitcher?
If I'm not, I should have been. He probably wish he could have had a steady lineup of me, you know, his
right.
whole career. I think the. After the fact, I started thinking about it. I said, you know, I wonder if I should have just told him what was coming. And then maybe he would have. You know, maybe he thought I was messing with him, you know?
Right.
And I might have had a little different success with him, but it didn't matter what I threw. It was always off the wall or over the wall.
What is that? Do some guys just have your number? Do they just go, ooh, I love the way this ball comes out
you
of
know,
his hand?
You just see the ball. Somehow you see the ball better off of certain pitchers. And maybe it was just bad timing, but he was a good hitter, too.
Yeah, well, of course.
I just caught him when he was always on.
Another random baseball thing I've always wondered about. I've always wanted to ask a pro player this. When you're on first, you see there'll be a camera shot of the first baseman and the guy is on base chatting. What are you guys chatting about? Because it always seems pretty friendly.
You know, it depends. I mean, sometimes maybe you played with the guy in the past, maybe
oh, sure.
in minor leagues or whatever. See the hot blonde over in the stands.
Right, sure. I mean, where can I get a good steak in town?
Yeah, right? where's a good restaurant? Where should I go? Where should I take the teammate tonight or whatever?
Right.
You know, it's really no different than just general conversation,
just
you know,
chit-chat.
Or sometimes maybe the guy got on via bleeder hit, you know, and the first baseman said, "God, how do you get so lucky?" You know,
right.
Things like that.
Maybe next time you hit, put your purse.
Yeah, why don't you try hitting the barrel next time? You know?
Right. favorite park to play in?
Wow. Some of them are gone now. I love pitching in Candlestick.
Oh, I'll bet.
You know, it was always cool. However they did their mound maintenance there, you felt like, I always felt like I was invincible there.
Yeah.
It was the way that the mound dropped.
Just felt good.
You just, it was just unique. I like pitching in the old vet too in Philly.
Yeah,
that was a nice place to play. San Diego was a great place to play. The weather all was nice and
the Murph.
Yeah,
yeah. Least favorite place. Least favorite park.
Detroit.
The old Tiger Stadium.
You know, it felt like you had to literally and. Unfortunately, in my last game, I was in a World Series, and that was not good.
right.
You're standing on the mound, and the confines of that old stadium was if you felt like you could turn around and reach and touch the outfield fence. That was just always the impression.
Well, they had the extended wall too, didn't they? It was like the it was like the padding, and then it was like a cage.
Right, then there was like a net, cage kind of above it, and then all of the girders. So, you know, you could have a seat that you kind of had to move right, move left just to be able to see. And then they had up above, they had that facade that they had built, and they had seating up in there, and it was a unique stadium.
Moving on to golf a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked about the transition. Had you played golf like your entire life, or it – one thing I read about you was you said during spring training in particular, mm-hmm. for a pitcher has quite a bit of downtime, right?
Right.
Especially in the early part of spring training. Can you talk me through how you sort of got a lot of playing time with golf? And
It was when I was in spring training with Boston, and when you play sports at that level, you know, it's highly competitive, and I'm a very competitive person.
I'd expect nothing less.
And I don't like losing, and I don't like if I'm not good at something. I want to get better.
Sure.
So that was kind of the way with golf. I went, for me, a typical day, a good round would be high 80s, you know, a typical round would be mid 90s. And,
right.
you know, as a pitcher, you're right. You have, even traveling, you know, that you have off days on the road, we try to always get together and go play golf. So during that spring training, I just said, you know, it was, I had a very frustrating round of golf and the ball was going every which direction or swing and miss and topping and everything else.
Right.
So I said, you know what, I'm going to get better or I'm going to quit. And I lived on a golf course during spring training. So every day from the first day I reported, a big basket of balls is 200 or 300 balls.
Right, right.
Okay. And so I literally, after workouts, I would go back and I'd go to the driving range and I would just bang balls. And I would go through a whole basket of that. And then I'd take a little basket and go over the short game area and just fiddle around. And so in the time period of spring training, my scores went from mid 90s to mid 70s.
Wow.
And you know,
that's a hell of a, I mean, that's distance.
Golf is not only about, it's not just distance, it's repeatable distance.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, when you start eliminating the missed shots, you know, getting back to hand-eye coordination, I mean, I'm still a great ball striker.
Right.
You know, but it's hitting the shot. You know, if you're trying to hit your pitching wedge 145 yards, well, you want to hit your pitching wedge 145 every time.
Yeah, sure.
And if you can do that, and you can take the directional from, you know, 45 degrees each way off target line, bring that in to pretty much down a target line.
Yeah.
Well, you start minimizing and eliminating a lot of those recovery shots.
Sure.
And that's kind of when I started, that's when I really started having fun playing golf.
Yeah, yeah.
So
when I spoke to Andrew, you know, he said, if you want to take 10 strokes off your game, if you want to go from an 18 handicap to an 8, he goes, where are you going to find those 10 strokes? And it sounds like what you did was, through a lot of muscle memory, you basically dialed in your game so you could you talked about repeatable distance.
Mm-hmm.
And Andrew, when he talked, tended to focus on the short game. But it sounded like you got every aspect of your game dialed in.
Well, it depends on the day.
Well, sure. That's true of golf every time. You've played a number of courses. Do you have a favorite track?
You know, Lakewood is, you know, I'm partial here. You know, there's so many great golf courses here in Colorado, you know, and it's all different styles. I mean, you can go from Ballymeal with the Lynx style. You know, Castle Pines Golf Club's always a treat to play. It's a great golf course, very scenic. Roaring Fork Club.
Uh-huh.
Over in Basalt is a favorite. As Aspen Glen is also, they're both fun golf courses to play.
Have you played Sanctuary?
I have.
What do you think of Sanctuary?
Well, I've only played it one time.
Yep.
And it was unique.
It's kind of a weird course.
It depends on the. I think it depends on the type of player you are.
Yeah, my game is not well suited to Sanctuary.
The day that I played, mine wasn't either.
Right.
But, you know, you have to know where to hit the ball, and you have to know the yardages. And I was, as a unknown going in there, you know, there was a couple of holes where I didn't hit it in the right spot, and it was just, you know, it was a challenge from that aspect. But, you know, I think it's a course that, if you get the opportunity to play it a few times, I mean, it was great shape, and it could be a fun golf course.
Yeah.
So
not one for walking, though.
No, it's mountain goat.
yeah, you need a team of Sherpas to help you with that one. Is there a golf course that you have not played that you would like to play?
You know, I haven't been to Pebble Beach yet.
Okay.
You know, last year I went to Scotland, and I've been to Ireland, and you know, I think if it was here in the States. You know, probably Pebble Beach is that I will hopefully live long enough to get there as a bucket list item.
Right.
You know, I think when you, Augusta.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know, I think those are probably two bucket list locations that I'd like to play.
Of course. How is golf different in Ireland and Scotland than it is here, or is it?
It's links,
yeah.
You know. Probably the biggest difference is people continue to play golf in that weather over there, and they don't here.
I don't know if you've been a little bit more guile.
Yes, I don't know if you have been to Bandon Dunes.
Yeah.
I've been out there. In fact, I'm taking another trip there this year. But Bandon Dunes has, I think, probably four of the top 100 courses in the country or world, whatever they have that ranking goes. Their golf courses are very compatible to both Scotland and Ireland. Lynx, you know, right on the coastline, and you know, a nice breeze.
Yeah,
but it's a great destination.
Do you have a favorite golf movie?
Tin Cup.
when I ask that question, it's usually either Tin Cup or Caddyshack.
Yeah, to me, Tin Cup. That's a little. I don't know. I just enjoy that movie more.
Tin Cup's great. That's one of those movies. That's a great Sunday movie.
Uh-huh.
Anytime it's on, you can come in at any point. And go.
I like the shot when he hits the pelican off the post.
Yeah, that's good. I also kind of like Don Johnson hitting the ball down the road.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, he's just outfoxing him at that point. That's great. Do you have a favorite baseball movie?
Let's see. The one with Robert Redford.
The Natural.
Yes, The Natural.
Huh.
You know,
yeah,
that was pretty cool.
You saw Bull Durham, yes?
Uh huh.
Is that a fairly accurate representation of minor league baseball?
Depends on the Saturday night.
Sure, hit bull, win stake.
Yep,
right?
it can be.
Yeah. And I'm ping ponging a little bit. Do you have a favorite pro golfer you like to watch?
Wow, you know, I really enjoy McIlroy.
Yeah, Rory's fun to watch.
You know, he guy, just great player. And Adam Scott's fun to watch. I'm going to be curious to see how, you know, new putter adjustments work for him.
Oh, yeah, because didn't they get rid of that? You can't use the long putter anymore,
I think it's January of next year is when that goes into effect. So I'm sure that in a lot of players' off times right now, they're working on, you know, those with the long putters are strategizing of how they're going to
Evolve from that,
You know, so
it's going to be tough. And then do you have any current favorite pro ball players that you like to watch?
You know, not really. You know, I watch the game, but I don't really...
You're not as up on it as you used to be?
No, most of the, you know, the guys that I know are still, are they're either coaching or in the radio or television, and I've kind of gotten away from the everyday player names.
Sure. I was going to guess Clayton Kershaw, just because he was a lefty. And
he's a Dodger.
Your animosity for the Dodgers. That's perfect. Well, I'll tell you what, Tim. I know you got plenty to do. It's a beautiful day. You got a full slate of golfers out here. Really appreciate the time. Now's the time where you can plug anything you want. So if you'd like to plug the club, if there's a place we can find you online, now's the time to do it.
Well, definitely. You know, the we're a, you know, a premier private country club, centrally located to downtown Denver. And what we're finding with our membership now is a lot of our new members are coming from the downtown area. It's, you know, 15 minutes or 20 minutes max.
Yeah, it's just right down the 6th.
So it's, you know, it's a great location. We're a great family-oriented place. And, you know, with a service motto. And the thing that makes Lakewood unique is the membership. It's a group of people, men and women, that just want to have fun and play golf. And I try not to screw it up, you know, get in the way of it. The other thing for those, and our website's www.lakewoodcountryclub.net. And so, you know, people can check out the public side of it. You know, and the other thing I think is as a PGA professional and going through all the ranks, you know, I've been a board member and an officer there within our Colorado section of the PGA. You know, we have a foundation, and our mission statement is to grow the game of golf. And so, you know, any time that golfers, I think, have or looking for a place that those extra dollars, if from donation perspective, is, you know, is our Colorado Foundation, our PGA Foundation. It's we support a golf in schools program that is hugely successful. You know, there's somewhere now 20,000 to 35,000 young men and women in schools that are learning the game of golf. And probably one of the biggest challenges that golf has always had is it's easy to go to the schools and give instruction. Mm-hmm. But what our foundation and our golf in schools program does is it makes that connection, and it actually on the fourth lesson gets the kids to the golf course.
Oh, cool.
And so that has been immensely successful.
Great. Fantastic. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's wrap it up. I really appreciate the time, Tim. I appreciate the insight into both baseball and golf. I love them both. And, man, continued success to you. We'll see you out there.
John, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And that'll do it for episode 69 here on the John of All Trades podcast. Big thanks to Tim Lawler for shedding insight about what it's like to be a Major League Baseball pitcher, as well as his time as head golf pro at Lakewood Country Club. So be sure to visit him. You can read more about him on the website, johnofalltrades.us, johnofalltrades.us. We'll also have links to Lakewood Country Club. If you're interested in learning more about that, please go to the website and check that out. Also, please check out our sponsor, 4 Degrees, number 4, DEGRE.ES. They are the proud sponsor of the John of All Trades podcast, and they provide amazing ability when it comes to online marketing and online campaigns. Targeting the people that you need to hear your message, they will get it to them in a very effective, very efficient, and very cost-effective manner. So check them out. The number 4, DEGRE.ES. The John of All Trades podcast is a production of Deft Communications. Check us out on the web at DEFTCOM jonathalltrades.us. That'll do it for this week. I'm headed to Portland next week. We will have a brand new episode. I'll tease that out on Monday. Check us out on the social media platforms, Facebook and Twitter, J-O-A-T pod for both. And a new episode will go up next Wednesday. And then I'm out of town. So until then, say goodnight, Gracie.